The Epstein uproar is felt in Palm Beach County. Hialeah's mayor-elect looks shut out of his own transition, and Venezuelans tell us who was killed in U.S. anti-drug attacks. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the new release of files in the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case and how it affects the victims here at the scandal's epicenter. We'll also talk to Hialeah Mayor-elect Brian Calvo about why the current mayor seems to be making the power shift there less than amicable. And we'll examine the human targets of the U.S. military's anti-narcotic strikes in the Caribbean and what's next for Venezuela as a U.S. aircraft carrier arrives. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Washington, D.C. may be the place where the noise is being heard about the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking scandal, but South Florida, in particular Palm Beach County, is where the pain is being felt. Here was where the millionaire financial advisor Epstein carried out most of the sexual abuse of dozens of girls 2 decades ago. Here also is where the alleged prosecutorial misconduct took place that kept Epstein from serving any real prison time until he killed himself in his cell after being arrested in 2019. It was also in Palm Beach County where Epstein carried on a friendship with Donald Trump years before Trump was elected president. Trump says he severed ties with Epstein in the late 2000s, but this week, Congress released more Epstein files that suggest Trump was not, as he insists, unaware of Epstein's crimes. Trump calls all that a hoax, but pressure is again mounting on him to have more Epstein material released, and those insisting most strongly are, of course, the Epstein victims who suffered here. Do you think President Trump and Congress should make all the Epstein files public, if only to finally get to the bottom of how Epstein could have committed this abuse for so long? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is attorney Spencer Coovan. He's the chief legal officer at Gold Law in West Palm Beach, who represents a group of Epstein victims, and he's playing an important role in getting more Epstein information disclosed. Spencer, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
You said this week that you were not surprised to see this new tranche of Epstein material coming out now. The last bit of it we saw, of course, was back in the summer when the Wall Street Journal revealed a very chummy 2003 birthday greeting to Jeffrey Epstein, allegedly signed by Donald Trump and bordered by his drawing of a female body. The president denies that was his. We expected to see more coming in its aftermath, but that didn't happen until now. So why now, Spencer? And why are you not surprised to see more of it being released at this moment?
So these particular documents, it's important to understand, they actually were disclosed in a federal lawsuit filed by some of the victims under the Crime Victims Rights Act. And what we filed down there in the Southern District of Florida, in Miami to be specific, was a case against the federal government for the sweetheart deal that they executed.
Right.
And the victims were never informed, which the law required. And as a result of never being informed, we sued the federal government to say that they had violated that act and sought to reverse the sweetheart deal so that Epstein could be prosecuted.
And Spencer, now, remind us what year this was.
So we're looking at about 4 years ago now, to 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So these documents were part of the discovery process in that case, but they were under protective order until recently. It's a result of lifting that protective order that now the general public is getting to see these documents that the lawyers on behalf of victims have known about for years.
Right. That's good context. Thank you. What stands out to you most, though, about what we've seen released this week by Democrats, mostly in the House Oversight Committee? Many are pointing, obviously, to the 2011 Epstein email in which he claims Donald Trump, quote, spent hours with one of Epstein's sex trafficking victims at Epstein's house. But Spencer, what do you find most significant among the items we're seeing this week, whether it involves Donald Trump or other figures?
Well, there's two things. I think that number one, we're seeing information that a lot of people had been talking about, but had never seen the actual pen to paper on these documents. So now they're seeing them. But understand that you know, these new documents only confirm what victims have been saying for now almost 20 years, and that's that Jeffrey Epstein didn't operate in a vacuum.
Yeah.
He surrounded himself with powerful men who either enabled his behavior or chose to look the other way. So the references to people like Donald Trump and others raise serious questions that deserve real answers. And again, not political spin. My clients don't care about party or politics. They care about truth.
Right. Now, you're familiar, as you've pointed out here, with the evidentiary material that was included in the Epstein prosecution and civil cases here in South Florida. What can you tell us, Spencer, about what you expect and hope to be coming out after this week, especially if the U.S. House next week approves a discharge petition that would yield an even greater volume of Epstein files? I know, for example, you've mentioned the likelihood of more photo and video evidence than we've seen up to this point.
Yes. And please understand that there are certain things I can talk about and certain things that I am still prevented from discussing.
No, understood.
But having said that, if the House votes and if the Senate also votes in favor, and if Donald Trump signs the law into place, then the release of these documents will likely show a number of photographs and a lot of surveillance video. We're talking about probably in excess of 300 hours of internal surveillance video at all of Epstein's homes.
Okay. I was just going to ask, when we talk about surveillance video, we're talking about video of the comings and goings of both Epstein and victims and other players in this scandal at his home. That's mostly what we're referring to there?
That is exactly what we're talking about. During the initial litigation dating back to 2008,
right,
I actually had done a walkthrough of Jeffrey Epstein's Palm Beach home as part of the lawsuit. And we could see the lawyers, we could all see that there were cameras mounted in the corners of rooms inside of the home that had been taken out. And the CPU units, the computer units that were storing that information, had already been taken off site by Epstein. The FBI now has those in their custody, and that's what needs to be released.
Do you expect this discharge petition to be approved by the U.S. House next week?
I do, but understand, like I said, this is only step one, right? The discharge petition might be approved, and I believe it should be and will be approved by the House. But then it's got to go over to the Senate, and they have to approve it as well. And then again, once they both approve it, it has to go to the president for signature. So if he does not sign this, it's going to be incredibly damning for him that he refuses to release this information that he promised himself that he would release.
If it does land in the Oval Office, what do you expect him to do?
You know, that's a difficult spot for him to be in. Like I said, if he signs it, it could potentially sign his death warrant when it comes to his political career. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't sign it, it could do the same.
What, though, are the most troubling questions still unanswered in the Jeffrey Epstein tragedy? Not just questions surrounding his relationship with Donald Trump, but the larger scope and effects of this sex trafficking scandal. You've mentioned, for example, that it was more likely what you call a pyramid scheme than just a crime committed solely by Epstein and his henchwoman, Ghislaine Maxwell, who is now in prison.
Yes, absolutely. I think at the end of the day, there's been a lot of talk about all of the other individuals that were involved in this, either as complicit participants in the organization or just people that were looking the other way. That discussion, I think, will be solidified. And like I've said before, a picture paints 1,000 words, but videotape paints 1,000,000.
Yeah. And so what then are the materials that would be most important? I mean, you've mentioned the surveillance video, for example, but what are the materials that would be most important in pushing the Epstein case forward? And I mean forward in the way that so many in the public in the U.S. are clamoring to see it pushed forward to, including, you know, we have to point out people in Donald Trump's very own political base. What are the most important things in pushing the Epstein case forward to the just resolution that the public and especially the victims need to say or to see? I mean, or perhaps I should ask it this way, Spencer, what does pushing the Epstein case forward to a more just resolution really mean? How do we define it?
Right. Well, understand that the criminal prosecution for Epstein and Maxwell is effectively over, but they were never never operating the scheme in a vacuum. There were numerous individuals that were assisting in the operation of this sex trafficking scheme throughout the country and throughout the world. He was operating here in the United States. He was operating in the Virgin Islands. He was operating over in Paris, where he had a home. And at the end of the day, the victims really want exposure for this story so that the world can see that this type of a crime occurs not in a vacuum,
yeah,
and not to just people that live in a bad area or bad neighborhood. These were wealthy, powerful individuals that span the globe that were doing this, and they need the world to see the truth of what happened to them so that hopefully it never happens again.
Right. And particularly since, well, you know, here in South Florida, we have seen other cases like
this
in the news in the past year or two. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with West Palm Beach attorney Spencer Coovan, who represents several of the sex trafficking victims of the late millionaire financial advisor Jeffrey Epstein, about the renewed drive in Washington to release more Epstein files, including those that might tie President Trump more closely to Epstein and his crimes. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Spencer, as I mentioned, you're particularly familiar with much of the evidentiary material involved in the Epstein case or cases from years back. But you've also pointed out that we have to keep in mind that we're dealing with two types of evidentiary material here, criminal and civil, which carry different standards of proof. I don't want to take our listeners too deep into the legal woods here, but how will those differences play out in terms of what Epstein material the public will eventually see and how they see it?
Well, I think we've already seen the edges of that so far when the Justice Department talks about disclosure of information. You know, they have said that they have disclosed all information and prosecuted all individuals that they feel could be prosecutable. That is a different standard. That standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. In order to prosecute someone criminally, that is an incredibly, incredibly high criminal standard, because we don't want to put someone behind bars unless we have no reasonable doubts that they are guilty.
I should ask you, if Epstein had not hung himself in his cell in 2019, would we have likely then seen that, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, a conviction of him?
Correct. I think that the evidence was very clear and very substantial, which is why he ended up dying in jail, because he knew that his death warrant had been signed, that the evidence was there. They had shown it to him. He knew that they had it. But understand that the evidence that the Department of Justice and the FBI are sitting on now, that is to be judged by the American public. At this point, we may not be able to convict people criminally for what they've done. But if we're going to have people in power in the United States, whether it be political power or financial power, then the public needs to know who they are and what they've done, regardless of whether it's prosecutable or not. You know, my clients don't care about party or politics. They don't care. Every person with meaningful ties to Epstein should be disclosed and fully scrutinized by the public.
Now, we also can't ignore the other facet of the South Florida connection to the Epstein scandal, and that's the years of alleged prosecutorial kid glove treatment Epstein received here, especially from then U.S. Attorney in Miami, Alex Acosta, and the Palm Beach State Attorney's Office. What more, if anything, could we expect to learn from the further release of Epstein files about their role in the leniency Epstein enjoyed for so many years until 2019?
I think, you know, I can say this with fair certainty that there will be evidence to show that there was an overly cozy relationship between the attorneys representing Epstein at the time and the U.S. government attorneys that were trying to prosecute this case. There were additionally some prosecutors, and I know at least a number of FBI agents back then, that were incredibly upset at how the U.S. Attorney's Office and Mr. Acosta handled this matter. And I think that with the full disclosure of information, you're going to see that cozy relationship and how it occurred.
Right. And we should make a shout out here to the Miami Herald and Julie Brown in particular for her investigation into that facet of this whole scandal. Right.
Absolutely. She was instrumental. Yeah. I helped. I spoke with her at length before her story was published to get her as much information that I was legally able to get her, because She was instrumental in helping this get forward.
Now, one of Epstein's victims, Virginia Giuffre, died by suicide earlier this year. But since then, other victims have shown a very strong lobbying presence, especially in Washington, to get all the Epstein files released and full transparency in the case observed. How important have their efforts been this year to getting us where we are right now with more material being made public? I'm thinking, for example, to the presence they made, I believe it was in September on Capitol Hill, no?
Yeah. And they have been absolutely pivotal in being able to make sure that our elected representatives understand the full breadth and scope of what happened to these victims. And I think that without them, it would have truly been impossible to push this as far as it has gone to this point.
How would you describe their mood right now, Spencer, as, say, you know, opposed to maybe a year or 2 years ago? Is their mood more positive now in terms of, you know, finally perhaps seeing that just resolution that we've been talking about?
Well, I think what that you find, and I've represented 9 victims, and what you find in the victims is there is no unanimity when it comes to how they feel about what happened to them. Some of the victims want to forget about it and never talk about it again, and some of them have. They've gone on to separate lives, gotten married, had kids, and have never discussed what happened to them to anyone, including their current spouses, that don't even know that they were victims because I've held their names in confidence.
Right.
There are other victims like Virginia that chose to speak up and come forward, and others in D.C. that have spoken up, and I applaud their efforts. But, you know, it's cautious optimism because the government has let these girls down so many times in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And they've been promised so many things that have never been delivered, that they're just frustrated and they just keep pushing. And I applaud that. Mm-hmm. And I applaud their tenacity.
Finally, Spencer, I wanted to point out you interviewed or deposed Jeffrey Epstein back in the 2000s. And you've pointed out that one of the things that stood out about him was that he considered himself the smartest person in the room, even smarter than his own lawyers. Apart from the files that look poised to be released, what do you want us to know about Epstein, the man, and what it tells us about awful crimes like this and how they can be gotten away with for as long as Epstein got away with it?
You know, it's interesting, and thank you for bringing this up, but the devil doesn't come wearing horns and with a mad face. Epstein was incredibly charismatic. He came with a smile. He wanted everyone to be his friend. While he wanted people to realize or think that he was the smartest one in the room, he could also just talk about anything to make people try to like him. He would, and this is public record, so some of my clients who were kind of isolated in the massage room with him before things got really bad, he would talk to them about school and what their goals were in life and where they wanted to be. And he would talk to them about how he could help them, you know, get into college or help with their art career, or help with their modeling career. He was incredibly likable. And that was the scary thing about him. And that is, frankly, the scary thing about these type of perpetrators is they are likable on the outside and exterior until that switch flips. And then all of a sudden you're captured and you're in their web and they take advantage of a situation.
Right. The lesson we need to learn. Attorney Spencer Coovin is chief legal officer at Gold Law in West Palm Beach. Spencer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Still to come, what's up with the mayoral transition, or the lack of it, in Hialeah? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Last week, 27-year-old Hialeah Council member Brian Calvo became the youngest person ever to be elected mayor of Miami-Dade County's second-largest city. And he won outright in the first round with 52% of the vote. Meanwhile, Hialeah's interim mayor, Jacqueline Garcia-Rovis, finished a distant third with less than 20%. Maybe she's angry about that. She hasn't really explained, but Garcia-Rovis appears determined to make Mayor-elect Calvo's transition to the mayor's seat complicated. This week, she all but ordered Hialeah City employees not to communicate with Calvo and his team before he takes office on January 12th. If they do, which would be considered normal protocol in a transition, she warned it will be considered, quote, a violation of administrative procedure and addressed accordingly. Garcia Rovas told the Miami Herald she's just ensuring a, quote, smooth and orderly transition. But a lot of folks in Hialeah, including Calvo, call it obstructionist. If so, the question is, why? What's your guess? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is Hialeah Mayor-elect Brian Calvo. Mr. Calvo, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me just start by asking why you feel you won the Hialeah Mayor's race and why Interim Mayor Jacqueline Garcia Rovas finished that distant third. I know the affordability issue, which, by the way, helped get another young candidate elected mayor of New York last week, I should mention, is a big one in Hialeah, too. But what got you elected?
Listen, I don't think there's any magic sauce. I think similar to what we saw in some of the other races, I think people nationally are ready for a change, a generational shift in our politics. I also, and it can't be, you know, said lightly, I knocked on over 13,000 doors in our city. I mean, it took over 6 months of work going directly to the voters, reaching them out, something that at least in Hialeah still carries a lot of weight with the voters, looking them in the eye and telling them I'm here to fix a lot of these issues that have been plaguing our city, things like affordability, things like a tremendous water crisis that our city is facing. We're paying some of the highest rates in Miami-Dade County and even in the state of Florida. And then we have, you know, some local specific issues. So public safety issues where we have a police department that has only 230 officers to service a city that we understand is over 300,000 residents.
And is growing.
And is growing rapidly.
Even as
so,
we speak, yeah.
So there are many challenges. And I think what, you know, large in part what people wanted is they wanted a change, a departure from the status quo.
So the big question then is, why would Mayor Garcia Rovas want to essentially handcuff your and your team's ability to communicate with current city officials so you can better prepare your incoming administration, if in fact that's what she's doing, which she denies?
Yeah.
But what might be the bad blood there hampering cooperation here?
Well, listen, I think the results on Tuesday, you know, they weren't necessarily unexpected to us, but they were unexpected to, I think, a traditional establishment that, you know, not only am I sort of this although I was a city council member for a few years,
yeah,
I was essentially an outsider going against the grain of the establishment. So to win so resoundingly, right, in a crowded field on Tuesday, I think that was a shock factor there.
We were all expecting a runoff in this,
right,
because
right.
We had five candidates.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
The second part of this is that, you know, this transition has never occurred in our city's history. It used to be that you would win the election on Tuesday night,
yeah,
and on Friday you were swearing in. So
exactly.
Now we've transitioned over to this almost presidential system where you have 2 months of a lame duck mayor, and then you have an incoming administration. There is no protocol. There is no, you know, standard operating procedure for this kind of stuff. And so I have a vision of what that should look like, and that's what I submitted to the city a few days after the election. And I think the mayor's approach is a totally different one. Now, legally, and
what is the contrast between your transition approach and her transition approach?
Look, I see this as it needs to be a structured approach where I am at least at a minimum sitting with every department head. We have 27 different department directors and division leaders. I need to have a series of financial information, a series of documents from the city, which I've done an extensive request of these things. And I need, you know, things as simple as office space. You know, I need to be able to tap into the IT network of the city, things of that sort to get my job up and running.
So now, do you think she felt that was a bit of an encroachment on your part, given that she's, you know, still in the mayor's
seat?
You
know, the undertone of this is that, you know, and sometimes people don't know this, but the mayor of Hialeah is a strong mayor, and it's a strong mayor much more than even the county mayor is,
right,
in terms of its
and
power.
Much more so than as opposed to Miami. Well,
certainly
Miami,
more than,
yeah,
certainly more than Miami, but yeah, even the county, right, has a lot of limitations. The strong mayor in Hialeah is an all-encompassing position.
Right.
And so I think the memo that we saw earlier in the week was sort of directed to let people know, hey, I'm still in charge, that being her, to be still in charge. And you know, over the next 2 months, yes, legally and technically she is. And so a lot of these decisions still come from her.
But we should point out, though, that perhaps this may have as much to do with former Hialeah Mayor Stephen Bovo as it does with current Mayor Garcia Rovas. And the two of them are political allies, obviously. You do have a history with former Mayor Bovo. You've clashed with him.
That's an understatement.
Right. You've clashed with him in the past over issues like Hialeah's controversial 911 dispatcher system. So could that be a factor in why Mayor Garcia Rovas is putting these restrictions, let's say, on your transition?
It might be, right? I don't know that to be true, but certainly, you know, it was very clear that the interim mayor was a continuation of Steve Bovo's administration. He endorsed her publicly, raised money for her. And I sued him, right? I sued him when I was on the council with these issues of 911 and all the stuff that I saw that was going wrong in our city. And mm-hmm. the word transparency, which is overused, is what I was seeking. I was seeking for information. Even as a council member, mm-hmm. I was not given access to a lot of these public record items. And that's what generated the lawsuit. So it does not surprise me. I think, you know, and that was a sort of one of the main hallmarks of the campaign was a lot of people saw her administration as a continuation of Steve Bovo, and that's what voters firmly rejected.
Now, as you mentioned a short minute ago, in years past, the Hialeah mayor-elect was sworn in as mayor just a few days after the election. Former Mayor Bovo had this new 2-month transition period set up. Why do you think he instituted a longer transition, and what's your understanding about what was exactly supposed to be done between the outgoing and incoming mayor during it? Is your understanding what you outlined there in that document that you gave to them?
It's interesting. So Mayor Bovo creates this new transition, but there was no policy, no procedure, nothing that was created in mm-hmm. addition to it. And okay.
So you were sort of filling in the blanks there.
Filling in the blanks that the city should have prepared, you know, whether it was me or whether it was anybody else. Now, I'll tell you something. The most optimistic view is, you know, this was created as a way to you know, allow a transition of government that was orderly and efficient. The pessimistic view is this allows basically 2 months for them to do whatever the hell they want, right? For lack of a better word.
All right.
So, you know, we'll see. Hopefully that's not the truth. I won't know until I get in there and I get to start doing an audit, which is one of the things I've said in the campaign that we want to do is, you know, we understand that there's a lot of shady stuff going on.
Well, that brings me back to sort of a follow-up here. How then, in a practical sense, does Mayor Garcia Rovas's communication restriction decree stand to compromise your incoming administration? How do you feel this affects a positive handoff of power, not just for you, but for the residents of Hialeah?
Well, it doesn't. And I'll give you an anecdotal, which is, you know, I was visiting one of the parks yesterday and a city employee came to congratulate me just because I had won the election. And then they kind of did a double take and they said, well, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to speak to you because of this memo, right? I could lose my job because the underline of that memo was, you know, if you violate this policy of speaking to me, then, you know, there will be serious ramifications of doing that. So, I need information. And I need information not only from the top of the food chain, those department heads, but I need information from just, you know, the everyday worker that has obviously some input. And many of them, by the way, are residents of our city. Yeah. So, you know, it's just, and I spoke to her afterwards. You know, we ran into each other at an event and I said, look, I'm far be it for me to tell you how to do your job, but I think that the tone that was set was not the right tone. It was a very aggressive tone. And there needs to be some collaborative approach because we can't do this, you know.
Right. Well, as I said, in a statement to the Miami Herald, Mayor Garcia Rovas said that what she's doing is in the interest of a smooth transition. So we'll just have to leave it there. We also reached out to Mayor Garcia Rovas and she and her office did not respond. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Hialeah Mayor-elect Brian Calvo about the obstacles Hialeah interim mayor Jacqueline Garcia Rovas appears to be putting in the way of his transition. And if she is, why? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Mr. Calvo, I want to turn to the challenges you face once you do take office in January, whether you have a smooth transition or not. And as I mentioned, affordability in Hialeah, particularly housing and utilities like water, as you mentioned, is one of the biggest issues there, largely as a result of that impressive growth the city has seen in recent years that we mentioned. How do you plan to tackle all that?
Look, in a nutshell, what you've had is a city where you have a bunch of single-family homes that are not used as single-family homes, where you have 10, 15 people. My neighbors, okay? I'm not talking about any other street. My neighbors, there's like 15 people that live there. You see it at night, 15
because
different
Hialeah
vehicles.
Receives a very large volume of migrants.
Of course, yeah. Absolutely. And so what that does is over time, it's put a tremendous strain on our services. We saw it with the 911 stuff. We were missing calls left and right. We see it with our police officers that they can't, you know, respond to all the calls for service in a timely fashion. That creates frustrations. We see it with our trash pickup where, you know, people fill up the recycling bin full of, you know, trash because the service is not enough for the number of people living in our city.
Yeah.
And then obviously we see that impacted in the rents and the affordability part of this. Water is also heavily strained because, you know, we have an infrastructure like many parts of the country that is a very old, aging infrastructure. And for many years, the decision was made by others to get monies that should have stayed in enterprise funds within the water department and use those monies to subsidize other parts of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that created is deferred capital improvement projects that now, you know, a perfect storm, all of these things come due. And so it is tremendous, tremendous challenges cannot be underscored that I'll be facing coming in. Mm-hmm. And look, I don't have the expectation that I have the magic wand and can solve every issue, you know, and I spoke to voters clearly about that. But we have to do it completely differently because, you know, thus far we haven't, everything's gotten worse, more expensive, right. and it's been a disaster.
We also can't ignore the fact that Hialeah is arguably the nation's epicenter of Obamacare enrollment, and the premiums for that are set to spike for Affordable Care Act recipients like them just about the moment you sit down in the mayor's seat. So what, if anything, can you and the Hialeah City government do to soften that affordability blow for your residents?
Yeah, look, because the mayor's office is a strong mayor and we are one of the largest cities, not only in the county, but in the state, I think you can't underscore the ability to have that bully pulpit as a mayor and speak on some of these issues, right? You highlight healthcare. Right. We have, you know, many of our residents on SNAP benefits and a host of other government programs. And so, you know, for a long time, I think mayors of the past have focused on local issues. And while those are tremendously important and pivotal, I think, you know, to a degree, you know, the use of the bully pulpit of the administration should be, in my view, would be to advocate on some of these larger issues nationwide.
Now, the Hialeah mayor's race is nonpartisan, but can you share with our listeners what party affiliation, if any, you share?
I am Republican, and by the way, all five people running
right,
in the
yeah.
race were Republican. It is Hialeah, after all.
Mm-hmm.
But listen, I mean, you know, politics aside, it's like, you know, you still got to do the right thing for
right.
the community.
Now, I mentioned earlier the policy clashes you had with former Hialeah Mayor Stephen Bovo, and one of them was a suit you filed against his rule that the mayor alone decides what gets put on the city council agenda.
Yeah.
Your suit failed, but now that you're going to be mayor, do you plan to change procedures like that?
Absolutely, and I think it's part of a sweeping reform that I've stated I want to do starting day one, which is to look at our governing documents. Many of these documents were written in the 60s. I'm an attorney by trade, and so I geek out about this stuff. And what happened in that suit is there was a total ambiguity in the charter, and as a matter of policy, for many years, the mayor has taken the role of not only being the mayor, but also basically presiding over the legislative function and setting what can be on the agenda, what cannot be. That creates an unjust system where there is no check and balance. And what I've told folks is, me being a good mayor goes far beyond just, you know, solving some of these core issues and being a good politician and then, you know, giving the gavel over to somebody else. I think being a good mayor means redefining the role long term to create more of a balance and a check on the administrator's capacity.
And finally here, while I think there's this image of you out there as a young progressive, There have also been some questions about what appears to be your more hardline stance as a Cuban American. For example, your call to go after businesses that allegedly launder money for communist Cuba, and the support your mayoral campaign received from the ultra-conservative Cuban exile and YouTube influencer Alex Otaola, who was a candidate himself for Miami-Dade County Mayor last year, and he said communists need to be pointed out and purged from public life here. Where do you stand on that sort of, you know, political stage, as it were?
Look, I think we all need to take a deep breath. And, you know, what I'm saying is something very simple. We have anti-money laundering statutes in the state. We have, obviously, Helms-Burton. There's a series of laws that are in place that are not being followed. And, you know, I think in Hialeah, we are, in the entire world, the city with the most Cubans living in exile. And we understand, and there's many allegations, well-documented allegations, that there is money laundering occurring in our city by members of the Cuban regime, by the way, of other regimes, of Venezuela and Nicaragua, et cetera. And so all I've stated is, you know, to the extent that we can, and it's in our power to do so, partner with federal agencies in order to investigate some of these allegations, create those, you know, investigations. If there's something there, then obviously take those to the appropriate authorities. And again, this is my training as an attorney, putting that attorney hat on, and let's make sure that the rules are being followed, that everybody's playing by the rules. But certainly we're not in a position to create new ordinances that go above and beyond what's already on the books.
Okay. Brian Calvo is mayor-elect of Hialeah. Mr. Calvo, thank you very much.
Total pleasure.
Still to come, who are the people who've been killed in the U.S. military's anti-drug strikes in the Caribbean? And what's next for Venezuela? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The big concern hanging over the U.S.'s deadly military strikes on suspected drug cartel boats in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific is that they likely violate international law. Even though the Trump administration has designated Latin American narco traffickers as terrorist combatants at war with the U.S., most legal experts insist they're still civilian criminals who must be dealt with by law enforcement, not drone missiles. But the other question about the attacks, which have so far killed at least 75 people since September, is who are those who've been killed? And are they all the narco-terrorists President Trump calls them? Or is it more complicated than that? Meanwhile, is Trump now ready to make anti-drug, if not anti-regime, strikes not just on the sea but inside Venezuela, especially now as the U.S. Navy's largest warship, the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford, joins his major deployment of military assets in the Caribbean? We'd like to know what you think about this campaign off Venezuela's coast, which we're told this week is being called Operation Southern Spear. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Associated Press reporter Regina Garcia Cano, who has been investigating the identities of the victims of the U.S. military strikes and watching as Venezuela braces for possible strikes closer to home. Regina, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tim. Thank you for having me.
You went out recently to Venezuela's Sucre state on the country's eastern coast, where these suspected Venezuelan drug trafficking boats that the U.S. military has targeted are thought to embark from. Crime experts in Venezuela have told me recently that the violent Tren de Aragua gang does, in fact, control areas of Sucre, especially in what's known as the Paria Peninsula, and especially a fishing village there called San Juan de Unare, and that seaborne drug trafficking is carried out there. But what did you go there for, and what did you find out from people there about who was on those boats that have been destroyed out in the Caribbean?
Sure. So I went to the peninsula twice, first in September, shortly after the first strike, and then again last month. I traveled to the area, which is on Venezuela's northeastern coast,
right?
Because I wanted to understand the dynamics of the region, but also I wanted to know who were the people on the targeted boats, right? Their names, their occupations, what drove them to get on those boats. And so what residents and relatives told us is that, well, the men had indeed been running drugs, but were not narco-terrorists, as the U.S. government has called them, or leaders of a cartel or a gang. Of those we identified, you know, one was a fisherman, another was a bus driver, a military school dropout.
And we should point out that, as you point, you know, as you say, these weren't really, you know, drug cartel leaders or serious traffickers. A lot of these are just men who are down and out fishermen, a bus driver, as you said, a school dropout. There is a lot of poverty in that area. And what I'm told, and I think this is what you found out when you were there, is that a lot of these people are just doing this out of economic necessity, perhaps more than any sort of serious, you know, criminal mindedness. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Yes, it is. You know, but residents, family members, friends of the men told us is precisely that, you know, and that's also what we saw when we went there, right? Poverty in the area is quite evident. And there are, you know, no job opportunities there. So many, many young adults, they drop out of high school, and, you know, they join the family trade, which is fishing, right?
Yeah.
And there are others, like, you know, the bus driver who was having financial issues, and he was offered the opportunity to get on a boat and took it.
Yeah.
And he did it twice. The first one, he came back just fine, and the second one, he was killed.
He was killed. Now, one of the other things I'm also being told there in Sucre is that a lot of fishermen along that coast now are afraid to go out, you know, very far, let's say, into the Caribbean where they can make a really meaningful catch of fish. A lot of them are afraid to go out now because they're afraid of being mistaken by U.S. military drones for drug trafficking vessels. Is that something that you heard as well when you were there?
I did. I heard that. And so they are, some are limiting going out to sea. Others, you know, they fish closer to shore. Most do that indeed. And then the ones who go far out, you know, they are indeed worried. And then what we were also told is that, you know, long time traffickers are not going out at the moment, and so they're sending out people like the ones that, you know, we profile in the story.
Right. They're finding the economically desperate people and then using them as sort of the victims then on these boats.
Right. And they're also, you know, we mentioned in the story the military school dropout who, you know, he had wanted to join, right? And he started as a lookout in industries, and eventually he earned or got selected to go on a boat because it's more profitable when they get there.
Right. So the situation is we do have to acknowledge that these men are going out and helping and participating in the seaborne trafficking of drugs, but the reality is they're not really lifelong narco criminals, and not the terrorists, for example, that perhaps the Trump administration has designated them. But what do Venezuelans there in Sucre say, for example, about the Trump administration's declaration that these people on these boats are actually narco-terrorist combatants who are at war with the U.S.? What do Venezuelan residents there themselves feel about this idea that the Trump administration has put forth that it can justifiably kill these men on these boats by military means instead of arresting them by law enforcement means?
So the families and, you know, the villagers that we spoke with, none really went into details about, you know, international law, right? That's not something that they that they were even considering. But one relative of a man told us that you know, the boat should have been stopped like they used to, right? And he was referring to what the Coast Guard, right, commonly had done, which is stopping, you know, the interdictions, basically.
Right.
So they would stop suspected, you know, drug carrying boats, and you know, people would be questioned and such, but they would not be shot. Right?
As a foreign correspondent, though, there, Rahina, were you surprised, for example, when Great Britain this week said it was going to cut back on the drug interdiction intelligence it shares with the U.S. because it's worried about the potential international law violations the U.S. may be committing there?
I think it's important that they are considering, you know, or that they're paying close attention to what is happening, and that, you know, it's not a business as usual, right? And so that they are considering what's happening.
I also wanted to ask you, one of the other things I've been hearing from people there in Sucre, particularly from experts on gangs like Tren de Aragua, is that one of the other big dangers is that aside from the actual drug traffickers on those boats, the gangs also traffic migrants and women who are being sex trafficked, and these people also could be killed on these boats, and they're, you know, obviously innocent of any of this crime. Did you also hear that there's a fear that very innocent people could be on these boats that are being struck as well?
I heard that during the first trip to the area. It is no secret in that region that the boats not only carry fish, but they also carry, you know, wildlife and fuel and migrants, women that are forced into sex trafficking. So, you know, they know that illegal things happen, you know, in those boats. So, you know, some fishermen told us during the first trip there that they are afraid, right, and that civilians could be hurt.
Right.
And indeed, you know, one of the people that we profile in the story was a longtime, you know, local crime boss who, in addition to drugs, he also you know, was involved in human trafficking, and he faced charges for that a few years ago.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with AP Venezuela reporter Rahina Garcia Cano about the Trump administration's controversial anti-drug military strikes in the Caribbean and what may be next in its campaign against Venezuela. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So finally here, Rahina, I want to turn here to what could potentially be coming in terms of U.S. attacks inside Venezuela. What's the expectation there inside Venezuela as to what the U.S. and the Trump administration may do next with its military assets in the Caribbean against Venezuela and the Venezuelan regime?
So, you know, if you watch state television here, the government is preparing, right, or it says it is preparing for what it believes is the real reason behind the operation, which, you know, the government here says is to force a government change. If you talk with, if you see people on the streets, if you walk around Caracas, you wouldn't see anything different, right, than you would months ago. People are going about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on social media, there is a lot of talk indeed. And you can tell that there is anxiety on people who support, you know, either side of the political spectrum in the country.
Yeah.
But if you walk around at least the capital, you know, people are worried about their day to day in terms of, you know, can I buy food? Can I, you know, will I get paid tomorrow?
Yeah.
But not thinking beyond that.
Right. Because we should also point out Venezuela is experiencing a very acute economic crisis as well. Right. Rahina Garcia Cano is an Associated Press reporter in Caracas, Venezuela. Rahina, many thanks. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Finally, on the roundup, we want to pay tribute to a South Florida changemaker who died recently, Seth Gordon. Gordon was born in New York, but whether it was the arts or politics, he was hailed for helping to move Miami forward. Gordon co-founded the city's celebrated New World School of the Arts, but he was also lionized as a publicist and lobbyist. He represented several major politicians, including the late former President Jimmy Carter, whose Florida campaign Gordon led in the 1970s. Gordon later went to work as a private consultant, founding public relations firms like Abram Gordon Vodica, Inc. and Seth Gordon Initiatives. Seth Gordon died October 26th under hospice care. He was 77. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado. WLR.